Good afternoon, all. I'm Miles Coleman. I'm a partner at Nelson Mullins Riley in Scarborough and chair of the Federalist Society's Lawyers Chapter. And on behalf of the Charleston, Columbia, and Greenville, South Carolina chapters of the Society, I'm delighted to welcome you to our event today. We are excited to be hosting and hearing from Senator Graham in just a moment, and then from a distinguished panel.
I'm here.
Good afternoon and welcome. Before we jump into it, let me make just a couple of brief housekeeping announcements, and then we'll get right down to what we're here for. First, we've applied for CLE credit in South Carolina. So if you're a South Carolina lawyer and you'd like credit for attending this event, I'd ask that I need a record of your attendance. So if you can, at the bottom of your screen, use the Q&A function and send a message that will be viewable only by me that has your name and your South Carolina bar number. When we're about halfway through, I'll remind you, ask you to do that again so we can make sure you're still with us. And then finally, at the conclusion of the event, I'll ask you one last time to send me a third message. I also want to very briefly preview a couple of upcoming events to put on your calendar. We'd love to see you there. Next week, on Thursday at 2 o'clock, we'll be having a virtual roundtable between three attorneys general, South Carolina's own Alan Wilson, Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, and Nebraska's Attorney General Doug Peterson. It's going to be a fun event, and I'd love to see you there. The week after that, on September 14th, Cato Institute's Ilya Shapiro will be with us live in Columbia and viewable by Zoom for those elsewhere to preview the upcoming Supreme Court term and his forthcoming book, Supreme Disorder, Judicial Nominations and the Politics of America's Highest Court. A couple weeks after that, we'll be hosting Judge Jeff Sutton from the Sixth Circuit and Ed Whelan to discuss their book, The Essential Scalia. Now, nobody came today to listen to me give announcements about CLE credit, and I know you're all excited to hear from Senator Graham. If we've ever had a speaker who truly needs no introduction, this is he, and I know you'd all rather hear from him than to hear me talk about him. So we'll jump right into it. Senator Graham, let me lead into my first question with a little bit of a windup. Since its founding, the Federal Society has been deeply concerned with the role of the federal judiciary. One of the founding principles of the Society is that in our constitutional system, it is emphatically the role of the judiciary to say what the law is,
right,
what it should be. Now, one of the ways that we do that, one of the ways we advance that principle as a nation, is by selecting and elevating judges who share that. Now, recently, under your leadership as chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, the Senate surpassed 200 confirmations of President Trump's judicial nominees. And for the first time in, I believe, more than 40 years, every vacant Circuit Court of Appeals seat has been filled. What does this mean? What does this achievement, this effort mean for the future of the federal judiciary?
Well, number one, to the Federalist Society, thank you very much for having me and honoring me. And I really appreciate what you do for the cause of good judging, giving us input about nominees. And I would say to efforts to prohibit people from being a member of your society and still be a judge, we'll stop that with all my might. That's just ridiculous. If you can be a member of the ABA and be a member of any group in good standing you would like to be, it's okay to be conservative and a lawyer, at least where I come from. The bottom line is, what does it mean? It means that President Trump has done more than anybody in my lifetime to reshape the federal judiciary to a center-right judiciary by focusing on filling every vacancy. Chuck Grassley was the chairman for the first 2 years of President Trump's term, did a great job. We've done 53 Court of Appeals, two Supreme Court nominees, 146 district judges, and we have 70 district court vacancies, 49 nominations. We'll probably do 30. We've done 120 on my watch. We've made it a priority. Mitch McConnell deserves a lot of credit. We're in the appointment business in the Senate. And I can tell you, for all those who campaign on our behalf and say that judges matter, Trump heard you. I heard you. Mitch McConnell heard you. And we have delivered. And here's what I would urge you to think about. four more years of this. Four more years of picking circuit court judges. We flip the second, the third, and the 11th districts. Four more years, we can flip more district circuits. Bottom line is there'll be at least a couple of vacancies, I think, between 2020 and 2024, and we'll have a chance to fill those if President Trump can get reelected and we hold the Senate. Think about that. Think about how satisfied you must be as a Federalist Society member of President Trump and the Republican Senate. Thank you for this acknowledgement. So the bottom line for me is that one of the big issues for the nation is what kind of judiciary you'll want to have. And I think that's going to loom large on the ballot. And there will be an effort by the Democratic Party, this is an expressed effort now, to expand the number of judges on the Supreme Court. They're openly talking about that. Numerous liberal groups are trying to expand it from 9 to dilute the conservative center-right agenda we've created. So I just think this has been one of the great accomplishments for President Trump, myself, and Mitch McConnell, and lots at stake in 2020 race.
Let me ask you a follow-up to that. You mentioned some of the statistics, the numbers of judges. So in the 8 years of President Obama's administration, a total of 55 federal appellate court seats were filled. That's over 8 years. Thus far, in less than 4 years, 53 seats have been filled under the current administration. So nearly on pace with right. What it took 8 years before. What does that tell us about the, the priority, the amount of effort and emphasis that Leader McConnell and yourself and others have placed on this?
It tells you everything you need to know. It tells you that in one term, we've done as much as Obama did in two terms. It tells you that Mitch McConnell and President Trump and myself see picking judges as one of the most important functions of the United States Senate and the presidency of the United States. We had two conventions, the Republican convention, Democratic convention, and almost nothing was said about protest and disorder in the streets. The Republican convention focused heavily on law and order and supporting victims of crime. And so what you talk about determines what your priorities are. I think we have done a good job of proving through our actions that when we talk about making the judiciary more into interpreting the law rather than making it from the bench, that we have delivered. And I hope people will remember that.
Let me ask you as well about a particular moment from the past couple of years. On September 27th, 2018, so this was right in the middle of the contentious confirmation hearings for then-Judge Brett Kavanaugh, now, of course, a justice on the Supreme Court. On that day, you delivered remarks at a hearing of the Senate Judiciary Committee that some observers have identified as crucial to then-Judge Kavanaugh's eventual confirmation, and that Ilya Shapiro, in his forthcoming book, Supreme Disorder, has identified as, quote, your greatest moment. Talk to us a little bit about that moment and about the obvious emotion, the passion that was present in the room.
Well, let's put it, why did people listen to what I had to say? Jeremy, because I voted for Sotomayor and Kagan. Nobody would have cared if I'd gotten mad about the way they treated Kavanaugh. I'd just been one more mad person. But I had something that nobody else had, the ability to look the Democrats in the eye and say, what the hell are you doing? I would never have done this to Sotomayor and Kagan. You know, you want power too much. There's nothing you won't do. You want to keep this seat open. You don't care how qualified he is. You want to make the pick yourself in 2020, and you were dumb enough to say that. What got me going is I've known Brett Kavanaugh for almost 20 years. I know him to be one of the most capable people any Republican president would nominate to the Supreme Court. Here's the one thing that united the party. Kavanaugh was the private secretary of President George W. Bush. He met his wife working for the Bush administration. President Bush was on the phone day in and day out calling Republican senators, vouching for Kavanaugh. So you had the Bush group, and you had the Trump group, and you had the McCain group, and the Romney group. All of us believed that anybody on the Republican side would have put Brett Kavanaugh on their short list along with Gorsuch. So what happened was we saw this as an attack on us, conservatism. We saw what they were doing to Brett being crossing a line of wanting power too much. I saw it in terms of an offense against a friend and a betrayal of what I had tried to do to right the ship. Since Clarence Thomas, Bork, Alito went through all this, everybody, every Republican, conservative is a racist, blah, blah, blah. I've never seen it so bad with Kavanaugh. Why is it always our people? So what I said that day, I meant, I looked every one of them in the eye and said, I would never have done this to your nominees. I wouldn't have chosen Sotomayor or Kagan, but I thought they were qualified. And Brett Kavanaugh was as qualified as anybody who's ever been nominated to the Supreme Court. He's an exceedingly good man. And what we were doing to him was unconscionable. And here's why it matters. If they had succeeded in driving him away and he had withdrawn, who would be next on our side? What young conservative man or woman would want to throw their hat in the ring and go through this garbage? You got to remember the accusations against Brett Kavanaugh were five. Three of them were anonymous, and two of the three proved to be absolute manufactured. And what happened to Dr. Ford, I think, was real somewhere, sometime. But I'm confident Brett Kavanaugh had nothing to do with it. You're talking about a party in high school where nobody could validate the claim. Everybody that was supposedly there said it didn't happen. And we're talking about how many beers he had when he was in high school and a party that was not defined in date and location. And it was just a complete low point in my career in the Senate. And I spoke up as I am right now. The more I think about it, the more pissed I get, because a lot was at stake. If they had succeeded in doing this, you would have changed the type of people that would come forward to want to be a judge, because a lot of people would be driven away. And anything they could do, we could wind up doing. So I think the best thing that happened here is that he made it onto the court. And I think they'll be less likely to do this to the next nominee because it blew up in their face. And I think it affected Senate races in that cycle. And I just want to let you know that when I voted for Sotomayor and Kagan, it didn't make me less conservative. I did what Thurman did with Ginsburg and Hollings did with Scalia, followed the traditions of qualifications, not ideology. And now after Kavanaugh, everything has changed, and thank God he is on the bench. And to the extent that I motivated people on our side to stand up for him, I am glad. But from my point of view, the real hero here, as much as anybody, is Susan Collins, because she had the courage to evaluate Brett Kavanaugh as a judge and as a human being and found him to be highly qualified.
So let me follow up on that. You mentioned a second ago Robert Bork, Justice Thomas, Justices Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Kagan, and then you said it seems like now all of that's changed. So let me toss out a couple statistics and then get your reaction. So Justice Ginsburg confirmed in 1993 by a vote of 96-3, yes. And spoiler alert, the margins are going to get narrower as we go. Justice Sotomayor, 2009, confirmed 68-31. Justice Gorsuch, 2017, 54-45. Justice Kavanaugh, 2018, 50-48. So the trend there, I mean, it doesn't take a statistician to see the increasingly bitter and narrow margins there. Is the continuation of that trend inevitable, or can it be reversed? Is this like a door that only swings one direction and it's never coming back?
I think Pandora's box has been open, and Kavanaugh shut it a bit as to how far you would go. But Harry Reid did more, I think, to unleash these forces than anybody in recent memory, by changing the rules to a majority vote for the Circuit Court of Appeals. when they had power, they went away from the 60-vote requirement to confirm a judge to 50 votes for circuit and district courts. They didn't go to the Supreme Court. The bottom line here is I think you're going to have more ideologically driven nominees because you really don't need to reach across the aisle and pick up a vote like you used to. I don't see the rules changing anytime soon. We had to change the rules for Gorsuch because he's filibustered twice. And I would say as to Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, nobody can look you in the eye with a straight face and say they're not equally qualified to Sotomayor and Kagan. So the point is that conservative nominees have been treated incredibly unfairly. It all crescendoed with Kavanaugh. When Harry Reid decided to change the rules, that's changed the entire nominating process. And what I fear over time is if we don't turn it down a notch, that good men and women will be more reluctant to want to be a judge because of what you have to go through. And I would say this, I think Kavanaugh having survived was a great thing because it shows that these tactics didn't work.
Well, Senator Graham, we want to be respectful of your time. If it's all right, can I give you one last question? If it's not an intrusion on your schedule, I know you've got other things, but we don't want to keep you from it. A little bit earlier in your remarks, you mentioned that I think it's something like more than 300 special interest groups, and a few of your colleagues have voiced support for the idea of expanding the number of justices on the Supreme Court. Now, this wouldn't be the first time the idea has ever been discussed, right? Nearly, I think it was a century ago, during the New Deal, there was a court packing plan that led to, my recollection from law school was the switch in time that saved nine is the phrase that they used. So there's been discussion of this at least once before, but it's never been done. It would be unprecedented in terms of being done. Do you sense that there's any actual support? Is there any likelihood of that going?
So look at Chuck Schumer. He's probably going to get challenged by AOC in a primary. So let's talk about some of the things that the Democrats in the House are openly talking about, making D.C. a state. Well, if you want people in D.C. and residential areas to vote, let them vote in Maryland congressional races. Alexandria was ceded to Virginia so people in the greater D.C. area could vote. There's a way to enfranchise people in the D.C. area without making it a state. If you make D.C. a state, that's two Democratic senators in perpetuity. They're talking about making Puerto Rico a state. They're talking about doing away with the Electoral College. In South Carolina, we've become far less relevant. But one of the most egregious things they're talking about doing is expanding the number of judges so they can dilute the center-right majority we have created over time. And from 2020 to 2024, there'll be, I would think, one, two, maybe three vacancies. But yes, they're trying to reshape the way our founding fathers created America to their advantage. They're trying to do away with the Electoral College. They're trying to reshape what a judge does and the number of people serving on the Supreme Court. They're trying to add states in a manner that I think is just overwhelmingly partisan. And if we lose the House and Republicans lose the Senate and Biden wins, I think most of what I just described has a better than 50-50 chance of coming true because they will try to change the rules of the Senate to do away with the legislative requirement, filibuster of getting 60 votes. Schumer and all the leadership in the Senate will be under enormous pressure from the left. So a lot's at stake. My opponent, we'll talk about where he's at versus where I'm at later on, and that's why we have elections. But today's about the Federalist Society. The day's about thanking me. I want to thank you for helping me make sure that we have good information about judicial nominees, making it aware to South Carolinians how much judges matter in our life, and to taking a stand for conservative judicial philosophy, which is absolutely a great thing to be doing. You shouldn't be ashamed of it. And any efforts to blackball your group will be met with fierce opposition by me and many others. So thanks.
Thank you. I know we've already kept you a few minutes longer than I originally asked for. So we appreciate your time. We appreciate your leadership and your efforts in Washington. And thanks again for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you all.
All right. Thanks to Senator Graham. We'll turn now to our panel. I'll introduce them in just a moment. And by the magic of technology, there they are, popping back up, unmuting their microphones, and turning their cameras back on. It's a distinguished panel, and let me tell you, if you struggle at all with an inferiority complex, you don't want to host a panel like this and have to look at their biographies and then rehearse it, because I'll tell you what, they've accomplished a thing or two. We'll run through some introductions briefly in alphabetical order, and then we'll kick things off. Excuse me. Starting with Mark Champeau, received his undergraduate degree from Brigham Young University. He was the valedictorian of his class, got his JD from Harvard, clerked for then Judge Gorsuch on the 10th Circuit. He's currently in private practice, but previously was the principal deputy assistant attorney general in DOJ's Office of Legal Policy, where, among other things, he personally prepared over 100 nominees for confirmation by the Senate, and in the process earned the Attorney General's Distinguished Service Award. Next, Professor Brian Fitzpatrick has an undergraduate degree in chemical engineering from Notre Dame, graduated first in his class from Harvard Law School, clerked for Judge O'Scanlan on the 9th Circuit, and then Justice Scalia, whose image appears over his left shoulder. He taught at NYU School of Law and is currently at Vanderbilt Law School, has received all kinds of awards and published all kinds of books and articles. And then lastly, Mike Fragoso earned his JD from Notre Dame, clerked for Judge Sykes on the 7th Circuit, practiced at Kirkland & Ellis, and he served as subcommittee counsel and chief counsel, as legislative director for Senator Flake, and as a deputy assistant AG at DOJ, and currently as chief nominations counsel for the Senate Judiciary Committee. So if ever there was a group of folks who knew a thing or two about our topic today, namely judicial nominations and confirmations, this is they, or this is them, or they know a lot about it. How about that? Let me start with a first question. And Mike, if it's okay, let me direct this to you. Okay. It's quite possible that a number of our viewers aren't familiar with some of the procedural, mechanical, behind-the-scenes steps that take place even before a nominee is announced. Can you give us kind of just a 30-second view of what that, a 30,000-foot view, or 30 seconds, of what that process looks like?
Sure, happy to. And Mark can fill in anything I miss. So it starts out when a vacancy is announced. So judge sends his letter to the White House saying, I plan to elect senior status, or he leaves the bench for whatever reason. At that point, interviews happen. So names are selected by the White House, by the Department of Justice, usually in consultation with home state senators, especially for district courts. And there are interviews at the White House, where in the current administration, the interviews are usually the counsel's office and the Department of Justice. The interviews have a lot of focus on methodology, trying to find originalists, textualists. They don't have explicit litmus tests in terms of how do you feel about Roe versus Wade, or how do you feel about Heller, none of that sort of thing. And in the case of district courts, there's a fair amount of mechanics in terms of what a district judge actually does. I think the jurisprudence is a little bit more important in terms of the interviewing when it comes to circuits, although it's still important for the districts. But for districts, there's also a lot of concern. Can this person do the job of being a district judge, which is a very hard job? After that, somebody's selected. There's vetting at the Department of Justice. There's vetting by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. After that vetting process, the person is nominated. After the nomination, there's also ABA vetting. The ABA does their review, which in the Trump administration and the W. Bush administration is all post-nomination. After that, a questionnaire gets sent over to the Senate. Usually while the vetting is going on at the Department of Justice, the questionnaire is being assembled at the same time. That's all the information about speeches they've given, articles they've written, most important cases they've litigated, people that they've litigated against, people that they've litigated with. And that coming to the Senate is what sets the clock in terms of when we hold a hearing. Usually about a month after we receive the nomination, that nomination paperwork, not the official nomination paperwork, but the questionnaire, we then schedule the hearing. There's also blue slips. Once the nomination happens, we usually send out blue slips to home state senators. They're actually blue pieces of paper that we send to them, and they sign back that they approve the nominee. If it's the district court, that's necessary for us to hold a hearing. If it's a circuit court, the practice is more varied in terms of whether or not a blue slip is necessary to have a hearing proceed. Then we have the hearing. People are pretty familiar with those. And then after that, there's just a committee process in terms of transferring the nominee under the Senate rules from the committee to the floor, after which they have their vote. And if they're confirmed, the president then appoints him or her. And they take the oath of office and they're good.
Before I toss out the next question, we're almost at the halfway point. So again, if you are a South Carolina lawyer, you'd like to get a field for the bottom of your screen, Q&A function, send a message, your name, your partner. I've gotten a couple of emails that can pop up, folks who missed that first announcement. So we'll use the email as your first login, but go ahead and check in right now at the halfway point. I'll address this to the panel. Whoever wants can jump on. One of the things that we've seen, I feel like over the past couple of years, that is a relatively recent phenomenon, both in the nominations context and in nearly every context, is how long past or relatively long past social media or college writing or grad school papers can come back to haunt a nominee. Talk to us a little bit about that. Is that a new phenomenon? Maybe it appears to be, or is it longer standing? And what advice would you give to folks who are currently in college or in law school about what they write about, what they post about, what they blog about?
No, Miles, this was one of the most disappointing, I think, episodes during the Trump administration, as we did lose one very good Court of Appeals nominee, Ryan Bounds, who was nominated to the Ninth Circuit to replace Judge O'Scanlan, because he had written some columns in the Stanford newspaper when he was an undergraduate, basically making fun of identity politics. And they found these articles and they turned them against him. And sadly, one of our senators from the great state of South Carolina, Tim Scott, was not willing to vote for Ryan, and so he had to withdraw his nomination. And so it's a really poignant and real phenomenon that you're describing here. My own view is this has been going on for a long time, and it's because I don't think that the Democratic Party can beat the Republicans on judicial philosophy. We have the judicial philosophy issue sewn up. When Elena Kagan, during her confirmation hearings, says we're all textualists now, I think we know that we have won the battle of ideas. So the only way that the left can bring down a nominee is to find something personal in their past. That's why they go to college writings. That's why they went after Brett Kavanaugh with the allegations they went after him for. So in some ways, it's a tribute to the success we have on the substance that these issues are used instead. But it's been going on for a long time. So I think that the conservatives have been with the upper hand on this issue on the substance for a long time.
I might jump in there. I agree, generally agree with everything Brian said. I do think that is the motivating reason why there's a focus on a nominee's past writings, also past associations, whether they were, a member of an organization that, today is looked on negatively for any reason. I do think that there's also the opportunity to find something there has grown a little bit, because we do kind of have, we saw in this term or in this administration, nominees around the age of Ryan Bounds and Naomi Rao, who, were writing for college newspapers during a very sort of politically active time during, I think, the 1990s. There's more today with the sort of college campuses digitizing their publications. There's more of that becoming available for people to find. And then finally, with social media, there's more opportunities for people who don't know that maybe in 5 years they want to be considered to be a judge to, you know, say something dumb or not dumb, but just not viewed appropriately or favorably by some people. So I do think there's a combination of circumstances that has led to this becoming a bigger issue. And it's unfortunate because it does put the focus on things that probably shouldn't be that important. Certainly if a nominee has done something in their past or has said something in their past that is, you know, by sort of most people's general standards, morally repugnant, right? That should be relevant. But to the extent that people have just, you know, expressed opinions and did it in a way when they were 19 years old or 20 years old that, you know, they might not have done when they were a little bit more grown up and mature. You know, it's unfortunate if we're deterring those kinds of people from public service by rejecting them on that basis.
Let me ask a question, Mike. In your comments at the beginning, you mentioned the ABA, the American Bar Association, and specifically you point out something that I think could be an interesting factoid that many of our viewers may not know. And you pointed out the fact that in recent years, the ABA's review process has been post-nomination. Expand on that a little bit and how that may have been different in prior administrations.
Sure. The ABA's role has varied, I think, pretty considerably from administration to administration. The history, as I understand it, is Eisenhower was the first president to sort of invite them into the judicial selection, judicial evaluation process. And they had a pretty standard role from Eisenhower, really up until George W. Bush, of when the administration was thinking of nominating somebody to a court, they'd give that name to the American Bar Association and have them run their own review. That process ran into some problems. I learned relatively recently, apparently during the Reagan administration, it got out that the American Bar Association was feeding these names to the Alliance for Justice so that they could prepare their opposition research ahead of time, ahead of the nomination. And certain conservative groups found out about this and then started saying, like, well, why can't we get that information ahead of time too? So we can start preparing their defenses. And the ABA stopped sending it to anybody, but that was sort of the background of it. And with that background, I think when second President Bush came into office, they decided to cut the ABA out of the process on the front end. So under President Bush, the ABA would find out about the nomination just when everybody else did, and they'd be able to do their evaluation afterwards. President Obama then put them back in the front end position. So the ABA was evaluating nominees before they were nominated under President Obama. And then when Trump took over, President Trump went back to the George W. Bush plan, which is they find out about nominees when everybody else does. And the trick with that is we move pretty quickly. And so at least early in the Trump administration, there was concern from the ABA that they weren't able to get ratings out by the time we had hearings. I remember when I worked for Senator Flake, we did a letter with Senator Hatch and Senator Cruz and Senator Sass and Senator Lee commending Chairman Grassley for just moving ahead with the hearings before these ABA ratings came out. But now it has worked pretty well. I think there have been relatively few nominees who haven't had the ratings, but the ABA doesn't find out about it until everybody else does.
Let me direct a question to Professor Fitzpatrick. And before I do, I should say I'm sort of trying to toss questions to particular panelists, but please don't let me, right? So if I direct a question to Mike, Mark, or Brian, if you all want to jump in, just, you know, raise your hand and don't let me cut you off. So I'll head it towards somebody, but please feel free to jump in and discuss as well. Professor Fitzpatrick, let me use one well-known example from recent years. But not to talk so much about that instance as the question of is this instance a recent phenomenon, right? How is it written? You've studied, you've researched judicial nominations, confirmations. So give us a little bit of a historical perspective. So when then professor, now judge Amy Coney Barrett was in her confirmation hearings. The subject, the fact that she was of devout religious faith became a significant part of that hearing. The dogma, as it so memorably was stated, lives loud with her. Is the fact a judicial nominee's faith, right? Which even somewhat distinct from whether or not they would be litigants fairly, whether they would apply justice, well, the fact of their faith and their degree of devotion thereto, has that ever been relevant in the judicial confirmation process? And is this a new feature? Is this a new thing that we're going to see going forward?
Well, of course, religion should not be relevant. But you know, the truth is this has been used against Catholics for a very long time. Are you going to follow the Pope, or are you going to follow the law, or are you going to follow the wishes of the American people? I mean, this has been a question hanging over Catholics for a long time. I thought we had resolved it, but apparently we haven't. I do think there have probably been many more overt instances of certain biases in the past than this one. You know, I think there was a long skepticism towards Jewish justices. And so I don't think this is the first time that we've ever seen anything of this nature, but I think it's the first time we've seen something this overt in a long time. And I'm sorry that we have. And, you know, I think, and this is something we're going to discuss today, I know that this is just a sign, these kinds of things coming back, of just how polarized and partisan the judicial nominations process has become. You know, the days when someone like Justice Scalia, just as devout a Catholic as Judge Barrett, could get confirmed 98-0, are long, long gone.
I'll say that I agree with all that from Professor Fitzpatrick, but having seen it happen a few times now on the committee, I think one of the tougher parts of it is that I think both sides kind of talk past each other or don't understand where they're coming from. So I think at least some of the Democrats really don't think they're applying a religious test. As far as they're concerned, they have no problem with a Catholic being on the court. There are plenty of pro-choice Catholics. There's nothing wrong with any of them being on a court. This is about determining their policy views, not necessarily their religious views. I think a lot of the Republicans see that and see that as, no, you're just changing the terms of the religious test. You're saying certain kinds of Catholics that I approve of are okay and they're good, but other kinds of Catholics are bad. And so I, at some level, I think they're both operating in good faith and sort of talking past each other in terms of, it's almost a theological or sociological problem, that different conceptions of what religion is. And they're kind of, it's potential for them both to be operating in good faith as they apply it, but the result winds up being this sort of longstanding problem of Catholics need not apply. And so there isn't a clear way forward. And I think Professor Fitzpatrick's also right that the overarching issue is just the increased polarization and the role that the court plays in so many hot button culture war issues where religious adherence is seen as a valid proxy for how you feel about those culture war issues.
Some numbers at you and get reactions to it. Mark, maybe we'll let you take the stab at this one. So we're talking about the number of filibusters where presidential nominee necessitated a roll call vote advance that moment. And I'll give you some historic numbers. President Clinton, 15. President George W. Bush, 39. And these are in 8 years, right? President Obama, 175, a significant uptick. All previous presidents prior to President Trump, all of them combined, 244. And President Trump, in less than 4 years, 314. Obviously, there's some differences of viewpoint and some procedural maneuvers being taken. What do we take away from this? What's the effect of it? And what's it tell us about the process?
Yeah, so, you know, it's an interesting thing to talk about because, you know, oftentimes it gets talked about today, especially, you know, when sometimes in the Senate, people talk about, you know, depending on what side you're on when the rules are being changed, you talk about, oh, this is so terrible, the rules are being changed, the norms of the Senate. And, you know, in terms of the filibuster, it's actually, as you point out, traditionally it wasn't something that was used for executive nominations or judicial nominations. And so, you know, when people lament, for instance, when the Republicans basically followed Harry Reid's playbook to do away with the 60 vote threshold to get past the filibuster for Supreme Court nominees, you know, there's just not a lot of historical weight to say that that was an important Senate tradition. You know, one thing that explains the numbers is definitely just the increased, you know, sort of retaliation, the increased partisanship that's gone into judicial nominees and judicial confirmations. Another thing too that I think explains the numbers to a certain extent is what Harry Reid did, right? Once Harry Reid nuked the filibuster for lower court nominees, circuit court, district court nominees, the filibuster was no longer a weapon that a minority could use to stop a nominee, but they could use it to delay or postpone a nominee. So once it's a different kind of weapon, I think that's in part why we've seen it deployed so much. I mean, now today, and Mike can tell you better than I can, but you know, it's basically just a routine thing today that a filibuster, so to speak, is done on just about every nominee, and you have to file cloture to get past it. So you know, I think it is unfortunate. I think the notion that that nominees, and you know, this really for the first time came up during the Bush administration with, you know, nominees like Miguel Estrada, the notion that a majority of senators that wanted to vote for them and confirm a president's nominee couldn't do that because a minority was preventing even an up or down vote was, I think, really a new thing. And that the use of the filibuster in that circumstance, I think, is sort of what led to this deterioration over the course of the Bush, then Obama, and now the Trump administration. So
the thing to keep in mind is until about a year ago, if you filibustered a nominee, you couldn't, as Mark was saying, stop her, but there's 30 hours of post-cloture time under the rules. So you could delay that nomination actually getting voted on by 30 hours, which in Senate time is like 2 days. We're not here all that often. So it's, I think that's why you have those 300 filibusters, is that 300 times 30 hours under the rules until we change them. That's just clogs up all the time and prevents us from moving on these folks. Now, they nuked that about a year ago to move it down to 2 hours for district judges and sub-cabinet appointments. And that's part of why we've been able to confirm so many district judges in the last year and a half. But it's, as Mark was saying, the weapon didn't exactly go away. It just sort of shifted in terms of how it could be used. And this was just a delay game. And it's still being played. So next week, hopefully, we'll vote on Diane Gujarati for the Eastern District of New York. She's part of a bipartisan package of New York nominees. She was the Democrat pick in that bipartisan package, and the Democrats still filibustered her. So we still had to file cloture on her. We're still going to have to eat up 2 hours of floor time to vote on her, and she's a Democrat pick.
Let me direct this question to the panel, and you can determine who wants to answer it, and multiple people can. So we've already, somebody mentioned in passing already, that it's part of the vetting process. That it's not litmus test driven, right? You're not gonna ask a candidate, are you for or against qualified immunity for law enforcement or something like that? How would you vote on a qualified immunity for any other candidates? But the goal, what I gather from the comments is that it's to determine a jurisprudential velocity. if somebody walks in off the street, how do you, I'd say something, if a lawyer walks in off the street, how do you determine his or her jurisprudential philosophy?
Yeah, so great question. It won't surprise you to know that just about everyone that walks into the Eisenhower Executive Office Building for an interview to be a nominee from the Trump administration will tell everyone happily that they're for a lifetime have been committed to textualism and originalism, and you know it sometimes is a challenge to sort of figure out what's behind the surface with that kind of answer. But you know, there are different kinds of questions that you can ask and that do get asked to see what do they mean by that, right? And sometimes you can tell who, you know, just maybe the week before decided they ought to read, you know, the Cliff Notes version of, you know, a matter of interpretation by Justice Scalia and had all of a sudden found their conversion to textualism. Oftentimes you can tell when it's sort of that surface level deep. For some people who are very, very smart, they get it, they understand it, and they can articulate it. And it's harder to tell whether they're really committed to it in a tough case. And, you know, in those sorts of instances, maybe you have a written record to go off of. Maybe it's a state court judge. These kinds of, you know, issues of statutory interpretation or constitutional interpretation, frankly, may not ever come up, even if they had been a judge at the state court level. So it does become a challenge, and you know, that's why sometimes you can get cues and information from people who know that person. And that's one of the reasons why during the process, we'll make phone calls and talk to people who've worked with them and know them and sort of tease out, you know, what kind of judicial philosophy they might really have.
You know, Miles, I have to say I'm a bit of a dissenter on the point that we can't ask the nominees questions about their views on these legal issues. I know politically it's easier for whatever administration is in power to have a rule that says you're not allowed to ask our nominees about what they might do. But from a perspective of a good democracy, I'm not sure it makes a lot of sense for the American people to have no idea what these nominees are going to do with this life tenure we're about to give them. And so I tend to think the American people have a right to know. The judges have life tenure for a reason, and that is if they change their mind later on in their tenure, they can still keep their job. So they're not going to be under undue pressure to follow whatever they say during their confirmation hearings. And so I'd like to have a more honest discussion with these nominees about what their views are instead of just dancing around these issues and trying to read tea leaves. It's too important of a position on the Supreme Court, especially, to leave to tea leaf reading.
One of the things that we've heard a lot about, I'll throw some numbers at you, and you can discuss whether or not you think the public perception is accurate or not. But one of the things that we've heard a lot about, and that I think the public perception is that under the Trump administration, the age of judicial nominees has drastically been lowered. So I guess question one, and let me give you some numbers. Question one will be, is that in fact the case? Here's the numbers. So there's the average age of circuit court, so federal appellate courts, nominees under the past five administrations. George H.W. Bush, the average age was 50. President Clinton, 50. And I'm rounding to the nearest whole number. George W. Bush, 51. President Obama, 52. President Trump, 48. So again, if we're looking at a narrow slice of the pie, right? Not district court, just the federal circuit courts of appeals. And President Trump, with an average of 48 years, age of nominees, is a couple of years younger. Back to the question, is the perception that all these judges are, you know, just barely out of law school accurate or not? And if so, even if it is accurate, is that a good thing, bad thing, indifferent? What's it tell us?
I I mean, I have views on this, but I don't want to keep talking if Mike or Mark want to chime in. But I think there's too much of a premium placed on finding young people for the bench. And the reason for the premium is life tenure. And I think that life tenure is the source of many of the problems in our confirmation process. I think that's what's led the process to become so polarized, so ugly. Both parties, frankly, are pretty ugly. It gets worse and worse every 4 years. And I think it all comes back to life tenure. These people can basically be on the bench for 40 years if you find young enough nominees. And I really have to wonder if, you know, the founding generation, if they had known that we would live as long as we do, whether they would have wanted that. And I do think it is a, you know, a fair question whether we ought to consider an alternative to life tenure at some point. It would de-escalate, I think, a lot of the acrimony that we'd see. It would allow some more seasoned lawyers to get a Court of Appeals nomination every once in a while. So I think it is a fair question that we should be thinking some about.
So put that idea in a thought bubble, because I want to come back to it. The if and how that would even be possible. So I do want to come back to that. You anticipated my next question, actually. But before we go to that, let me see what Mark and Mike have to say about the are they in fact younger? I mean, the numbers don't necessarily seem to bear that out.
You know, I think there have been a handful of nominees that have been maybe a little bit younger than you might have seen in prior administrations. But, you know, when we're talking about a talent pool of, you know, lawyers in the country, really high qualified lawyers who could be a federal judge, who can do a good job as a federal judge, your talent pool isn't so small that, you know, you're only going to find qualified people once they've got, you know, reached the age of 55. Or that the difference between 50 and 48 means that you have some drop-off in quality. I think Professor Fitzpatrick is absolutely correct that, you know, the desire to nominate where possible someone who's a little bit younger is because of the time that they can spend on the bench and the fact that, you know, if you nominate someone who's a little bit closer to retirement age, you're in some ways just turning that seat right over to your successor in the presidency. Whereas if you nominate someone a little bit younger, there's some staying power. But I would, you know, certainly take on anyone who would argue that a 2-year difference, you know, 50 to 48 has meant some decline in quality of nominees. I think it's actually just the opposite. I think the quality of nominees has been higher than ever. And, you know, I can tell you from having sat through a lot of interviews of more experienced, distinguished lawyers and sort of understanding, seeing some of the talent pool, you know, across the different age spectrum, that you can find some pretty terrible judges and pretty terrible lawyers that have lots and lots of experience. Just as much as you can find terrible lawyers who are terrible because they don't have any experience. So I don't think it's a direct correlation.
And let me just say very, very quickly, Miles, I absolutely agree with Mark. President Trump has nominated the most talented people for judgeships in American history. His judges are even better than Ronald Reagan's, in my opinion, and that's a very high bar. And so you're right. There's absolutely no necessary correlation between the two.
I think it's also the average might not quite capture it. I suspect if you look at sort of the total distribution, Trump's judges are probably a little bit more bimodal than, say, Obama, where they were probably more clustered around 51 or 52, whereas with Trump, you probably have a decent number who are in their lower 40s and then some who are on the older side, and the average is meeting in the middle. And I think part of that is, frankly, coalition politics, where it goes to the ABA, right? How the ABA has a part of why under Democrat administrations, the ABA has a seat in the process is the bar is part of the Democratic coalition. And so that is actually the trial bar, the established attorneys, are people that Democrats typically need to placate in their judicial nomination process, which with Republicans, I don't think that's really so much the case. It's more of a jurisprudential issue rather than a coalitional issue.
So what I'm hearing you say, to use a sports analogy, is that Pat Mahomes or Stephen Curry can and should be MVPs of their respective leagues at a young age based on performance, based on ability, and not seniority, playing in the NFL and the NBA respectively. Same thing I hear.
Fair. But then also I agree with Professor Fitzpatrick that across the board, they have all been great. And, you know, there is something to a lot of President Trump's young judges have been fantastic. And at the same time, some of his very strongest judges have been some of his oldest. So Judge Katsas in the DC circuit, Judge Collins on the Ninth Circuit. He's so impressive that the LA Times had a leak-filled hatchet piece against him not too long ago because his colleagues were so annoyed at how good of a job he's doing. Judge Bennett in Hawaii, I think, is probably our oldest circuit judge, and he's been just an absolute dynamo out in the Ninth Circuit. So I think the administration has done a good job of not sort of boxing itself in that we only have to go young, or they only have to go young, or only have to go old.
So we've got just a couple of minutes left. I want to be respectful of our panelists' time and of our viewers. Let me make one last announcement. So if you're getting the South Carolina CLE credit, this is your final check-in. Use the Q&A function, send the name and the bar number, and we'll have a record of attendance. Now, in the brief time that's left, I do want to circle back, Professor Fitzpatrick, to the concept that has been raised by some of moving away from life tenure to some alternative system. How is that possible, right? Can that be done statutorily? Right, the idea is it would de-escalate the process. How is it done? What are the chances of that happening? And what's it? And anyone can feel, I'll let you start, Brian, but anybody can chime.
You know, the leading proposal, which I support, I have to say, is to give every justice one 18-year term. And the terms would be staggered. So every 2 years, another term would end. So every president would get two nominations every 4-year term. And I think this would de-escalate all of this acrimony because, you know, even if you don't get this nominee, someone you want, the next nominee could be yours 2 years from now. And could it be done statutorily? There are theories that say yes. The theories depend upon making the justices that are coming up at the end of their term into senior justices. I don't know if I buy that, but you know what? If we have to amend the Constitution, then we have to amend the Constitution. I think we're getting so bad with the acrimony that both sides at some point may be willing to do something as drastic as that.
Mike, Mark, any thoughts?
I haven't really thought about it. It's an interesting idea.
Yeah, Sam, I think it's very fascinating. And I certainly think that it can be helpful if smart people from both sides are trying to collaborate together and think of ways to de-escalate and ratchet some things back, because you know I don't think many people will argue that the never-ending escalation of the partisanship of judicial nominations is a good thing.
Well, I've got more questions that I wish I could ask. I wish we had more time, but all that means is we're going to have to get back together and do this again at some point in the future. Thank you all so much for your time. Really appreciate it. Fascinating discussion. And we're grateful for it. Thanks to our viewers. We hope that all of you have a safe and enjoyable long holiday weekend. Thanks, and we'll hope to see you at a future event.
Thank you.